You're listening to Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. To learn more about our organization, visit sshsa.org. My name is Amy Bachari, and I'm the Education Director. Today, I'm at the Arklow Maritime Museum in County Wicklow, Ireland, to speak with historian Jim Rees about the role of two Arklow fishing vessels that came to the aid of the Lusitania on the 7th of May, 1915. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Can we start by hearing about your background in history, the books you've written, and your role here at the museum?
I was always fascinated by history. I was born here in Arklow and I spent all my life here, except for 5 years over in Liverpool in England. And it was just the history of the place, and particularly maritime history, because Arklow is such a maritime-minded town. And it was impossible to be born down around, particularly in the fishery area of Arklow, not to be caught up in history, not to be caught up in the maritime element. And that led into a few things. My other interest, I was always interested in writing from my very early teens. So it was nice to have the two interests blend. That I'm not a novelist, I just can't make stuff up. But if you're into history, there's better stories have already happened. You just have to find them. You just have to investigate them more. And I've always said, I don't care if you're interested in politics, warfare, romance, you name it, gangsterism, better stories have really happened. And even in a small town like this, the number of stories, the richness is all there. And so in 1985, me and another guy, Liam Charton, decided all the ships that had been here and had come and gone, and there was no record between two covers of those ships. It was all there in lodge registers and everything else, but not in a book form. So we researched and wrote Arklow, Last Stronghold of Sail, and that brought the ships from the earliest we could find right up to 1985 when the book was published. That then I was looking for something else when that book was done, and I came across Robert Halpin from Wicklow Town, 15 miles up the coast. And Halpin was a major 19th century international figure because of telegraph cable laying across the Atlantic and elsewhere right down to Australia. And he was also the longest serving commander of the largest ship on the planet, the Great Eastern. This was a guy who was born 15 miles up the coast and died up there. He always came back. There's something about places like Arklow and Wicklow. You can go away, all right, but you're pulled back. There was a time in Halpin's career when he was involved in emigration ships going across. That led me to famine emigration from the Arklow area. There's books, Farewell to Famine and Surplus People came out of that. And then there's been a few other books as well, like the history of the local lifeboat station. I'm now chairman of the Arklow Maritime Museum. The museum was set up in 1976. So we're coming up to 50 years, round to go now. And I've been chairman for the last 4 years. And we're really getting a second wind. We've doubled the size in the last 2 years, and the visitor numbers are really up.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Arklow and why there is such a strong maritime connection here?
Arklow is probably one of the oldest towns in Ireland, and it's credited with being founded by the Vikings who came here in the early 9th century. How much of that embryonic town was really, it said, just a trading post and things like that? And when did it slowly coalesce and develop into the makings of a town is open to question, but definitely it's Viking origins. And there have been people living in the area for 5,000 years before, but pre-Viking Ireland didn't have towns. The houses were dotted around. They didn't have the street systems like we know today. And so it was the Vikings established the first towns in Ireland, Dublin, Cork, Wicklow, Arklow, Wexford, Waterford, so on. And So there's always been that maritime element. People who were in Ardal never looked at the land. They always looked to the sea for fishing, for trading, and so on. So much so then that even when we get into the 19th century, the first RNLI station in Ireland was here in Ardal, established in 1826. It's coming up to 200th anniversary now. There's always a thing, and as I say, where if you were born in a fishery area, you weren't thinking about it all the time, but you're just conscious of this maritime heritage.
Yeah, it's all around you.
Yeah, you couldn't avoid it.
Can you talk about the Maritime Museum here and what are the types of things visitors might see on display?
As I mentioned, the Maritime Museum actually opened in 1976, but it had been three years before that, trying to get it together. In the 1960s, Ireland had its very belated industrial revolution. It had always been agriculture. And then the 1960s realised it's going to have to finally come into the 20th century. And government policies were there. There were some very good politicians who could see beyond the next election and what was good in the long term. And obviously, I mean, life at sea, whether you're sea trading or fishing, it's hard. Suddenly you're offered a job at home, better wages, more security, and easier work. So an awful lot of people did turn their back on the traditional occupations and went into local factories that were springing up. And then suddenly, by 1970, certainly, people were looking at, it was no longer a rich tradition. It was a reminder of poverty. And all these souvenirs that come from all over the world were being dumped into skips and dumpsters. And a Christian brother in local school here in about 1972 or 73 thought, God, this is terrible. And other people started to be aware of it too. We're losing all this heritage. And so this Christian brother got some of the sixth-year students to go around and collect as many items as possible, organise an exhibition over St. Patrick's weekend of 1973. Patrick's Day, I think, fell on the Sunday that year, but decided to have a weekend. And, of course, you had the bank holiday after it, so there was a three-day exhibition in the school. And over 3,000 people filed through. Now, don't forget, the population of Ardal at that time was about 6,000. But 3,000 people filed through that exhibition. Everything was documented from start to finish, how much money was spent on postage stamps and what came in and who had what. But people realised, we have to stop this, we have to save this heritage. And it took about 3 years then, a committee was formed and work carried on, and it opened in 1976. It was further up the town at that time on the railway road. It was there until 2009. In 2009, we had this option of a space here in the Bridgewater Shopping Centre, and we took it up. And 2 years ago, we extended into this adjacent unit. So we're now twice the size, and we've over 2,000 exhibits. It's still mainly maritime, but we're trying to be more inclusive because I know we find it difficult, but an awful lot of people are put off by the word maritime. They're, oh, I'm not interested in boats. I'm not going in there. Yeah. So we're trying to get this across. You cannot have a museum of Ardal that is not going to be at least 70% maritime. But we are opening up to that 30% as well to tell the fuller picture. So that's the process we're in at the moment. We're a strange structure in that we're a community museum. We are not a county council museum or anything like that. We don't get, there is no funding there, on a regular funding. We keep the lights on by the people coming in the door. And we're governed by a voluntary committee. At the moment, there's 11 on that. But the day-to-day work is carried out by six staff who are paid through community enterprise schemes. And that's brilliant, and that allows us to be closed for only 4 days a year. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Stephen's Day, and New Year's Day. That's it. We're open every other day of the year.
So let's move on to the Lusitania now. Can you give us a bit of a brief history about the ship, what happened to it, and why it was important to the course of World War I?
The Lusitania was one of the finest ships at the turn of the century. It was really up there with the Lusitania, the Mauritania. These were world-class, blue-ribboned vessels. And when World War I broke out in 1914, there was always the element, Britain particularly was from the beginning trying to get America to join in on that. But America had its non-interventionist policy at the time and it said, no, let Europe look after its own problems. It was always going to take a major attack on American citizens or American property to change that. And there's the suspicion now in the Lusitania or something similar was always going to be used as a pawn in the whole thing. The Lusitania in May 1915, left New York bound for Liverpool. And it was suspected, even at the time, that she was carrying munitions, which was a no-no. That made her a combatant. And as she approached Ireland, vessels that should have been in the area, British support vessels, but for some reason were not. Because it was already known that there was a German U-boat, U-20, operating in the approaches to down of Southwest Ireland. And the U-20 saw the Lusitania, had the order because it was believed she was carrying munitions, and she was torpedoed. Now, like any normal human being, I don't understand how anybody could do that. But in a time of war and somebody acting on orders, I still don't really understand it, but I'm not in that situation. But if you get the order, look, this is a legitimate target, fire. Equally, the Germans obviously were really condemned for that action. But equal condemnation is deserving if the whole thing was engineered. It goes right across the board. Because the bottom line were there were well over 1,000 people lost their lives on that. Because there were so many Americans on it, then America started to take notice. Look, this is an attack. And there was a division in the States at the time. Should we join in? Should we not? This gave ammunition to go to our lobby. And that is why it is so important. It took another 15 months or so, but it did actually bring America into the war on the side of Britain and France. And so that's why it's important.
Can you talk about why there were Arklow fishermen in that area at that time?
The Arklow fishermen's year was very strange, very different to a land-based community. You had to follow the shoals where they were at different times in the year. And always between, when you get to February in the year, the fishermen would start checking out their boats, checking out their gear, everything was ready after the winter and so on. And then they would get to St. Patrick's Day, 17th of March, and would have presumably a fairly good Patrick's Day. So either the day after that or maybe the day after that.
depending
on how good the nets were. And they would head down then to West Cork for the mackerel fishing off Kinsale. And it would be in West Cork from mid-March until the end of May. That's why it's strange. If you look at the 1901 and 1911 census for Arklow, as I've done a lot of research into it, there's so many fishermen missing. They're all down in West Cork on the night of the census, which was always the end of March. And so they were down there, and on the 7th of May, 1917, the Lusitania was attacked. Hundreds of people in the water within minutes. Two of the first vessels out to pick up these survivors were two of the Arklow fleet. There were well over 80 Arklow boats down there. It was a big fleet. And there was Captain James Hagen of Dan O'Connell and Captain Eddie White of the Elizabeth. And they picked up some. Now, it's a very complicated story. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read an excerpt because this has to be got right.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And this is from the book Maritime Arclaw by Frank Ford. This is what appeared in the local newspaper of the time, the Wicklow People. And you can see how partisan it is. "While during the last week the whole civilized world has been horrified by the cruelty and cowardice of the Germans in sending the huge liner Lusitania to the bottom of the sea with hundreds of human souls, it is with certain pride that we ascertain that some of the brave Arclaw fishermen, ever responsive to the cause of distress, played a very prominent part in the heroic work of mercy. The Arclaw steam drifter Dan O'Connell happened to be in Kinsale. When the report of the sinking was brought in, she proceeded in haste to the scene of the disaster and picked up the first of the Lusitania's lifeboats, containing about 40 people. Captain Hagen put one of his men on board to pilot her into Kinsale and continued on towards the wreck. In a letter to a friend, he said that such a scene was impossible to describe. There were about 12 boats picking up the living and dead, while the first boats were returning to land survivors. He himself went on to pick up the dead and landed about 60 bodies of well-dressed people and towed in one of the lifeboats containing 30 dead bodies. Some of the other Arclaw boats in the area were also on the scene." Now, the interesting thing about it, it mentions there that they took, Dan O'Connell took in one of the Lusitania's lifeboats containing 40 people, but were intercepted by one of the British tugboats who had gone to the area. As I said, Dan, James Hagen had Dan O'Connell, and the Elizabeth was Eddie White. Dan O'Connell and Elizabeth were halted by, this is very strange, very interesting, were halted by the naval tug Stormcock as they returned with survivors. Eddie White, the skipper of the Elizabeth, was off the harbour mouth of Kinsale when Commander Shee of the Stormcock halted them and ordered them to hand over the survivors. White protested, as did Jimmy Hagen of the Dan O'Connell, that there were others waiting to be rescued at sea. Some of the women on board said White were in a very bad way. He wanted to get him to Kinsale as quickly as possible. But she threatened, "If you don't stop, we shall sink your boat." Mm. The Elizabeth's boat from the Lusitania was taken in tow by the Stormcock, which headed back to Kinsale. Now, that was such a waste of time, and their bodies, their people lost because of that delay. But that threat that they were going to blow these out of the water if they didn't command, and they were told to go back into Kinsale and not come out, they couldn't resume fishing on the hills for 4 days. And don't forget, there were no social welfare, anything else, that was last time, even looking at it on that level. So they were made go in until the whole thing of the Lusitania had died down. Lusitania had sunk, there was nothing else to see. And the rescue operations, the Royal Navy, for whatever reason, did not want the rescue operation seen by these private boats. There was an inquiry into it, and I've read it several times, and I can't really understand the full outcome of it. A lot of it came, the information came under war censorship. And so that covered a multitude. But what happened then when, after 4 days, and Dan O'Connell and the other Arclaw boats were allowed back out to sea, they said no point resuming fishing. Their heart wasn't in it anyway, so they just came home. And while they were on the way up from Kinsale back up to Arclaw, they were sorting out the nets and things like that. They found a shoe. It is the shoe of a teenage girl. Now, we don't know her nationality. We don't know her name. We know absolutely nothing about her. For a while, we said, at least it's upbeat, because she must have survived. She must have been taken out of the water for her shoe to be under Dan O'Connell. Until you come across the reference that Dan O'Connell also took on some dead bodies. Now we can't be sure. Is that shoe that we have here in the museum, is that shoe from the survivor or a victim? We don't know.
Oh, bit of a mystery.
Absolutely a mystery. And I reckon it's one of our favourite items here.
It's an interesting story, yeah. And I think it creates a bit of mystery too.
It does, and I think it's such It is such a massive story. Here's one of the finest ships at the time, pivotal in getting America into the war. And it's all big, big screen stuff. But here's a shoe belonged to a teenage girl that suddenly makes it pretty human.
Yeah. So the Arklow fishing boats only got one attempt at rescuing people. Is
yeah,
that right?
And
because
we're
then
not
they
allowed
were stopped.
Back out. No.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You would think you would allow any boat in the area to assist in any way.
Well, you look at the other side of kind of the same coin at Dunkirk. The British were begging for boats of all sizes to go to Dunkirk to rescue fellows to get them back, understandably.
Right.
But they would not allow that for the Lusitania 25 years earlier.
Yeah. Interesting.
Very.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, that is a pleasure.
The Arklow Maritime Museum is open daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., except for Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, St. Stephen's Day, and New Year's Day. Because it's a community-run museum without government funding, admission fees ensure that the museum can continue its work. It costs €7 for an individual, €5 for seniors or students, and €15 for families. Thank you for listening to this episode of Ship History Radio. We hope you enjoyed hearing about the Arklow Maritime Museum and Arklow fishermen's role in the rescue of the Lusitania sinking. You can learn more about our podcast at shiphistory.org/radio. To learn more about the Steamship Historical Society, visit sshsa.org.